Okay, so let's get started here. Few announcements. There's a project due today. Several people sent me mail saying the due date, the time it was due is 5 in the evening and Spark is open till 9. So which of the two should you follow? And I pointed out to people that it's actually spelled out in the syllabus. All assignments are usually due end of business day, which is 5 o'clock. We leave Spark open till 9. So you can submit until 9 for no late penalty. Your computer crashed, you went home, your internet connection died. You have 4 hours to deal with all these problems and still not have a late submission. Okay? So this is usual policy. It's always been the case. It's nothing new. So you will see that Spark will continue to accept things till 9. So feel free to submit at any time before then. Okay, after this it will be marked late. You have 3 late days, as you probably know. That's also spelled out in the syllabus. So feel free to use it as you want. In this case, I highly recommend that you wrap the assignment up and move on to the midterm. If you take more time, you will have less time for the exam. So just keep that in mind. Okay, that's one. I sent out a homework, put out a homework which is essentially a midterm exam from a previous offering of this class. This is required for, it's not an optional thing. So you have to turn it in. It's due on Monday. On Tuesday morning, I will actually make the solutions available. So you can go and check your solution against the official solutions. It won't be graded in time for your midterm, obviously. Okay, because it's due on Monday and the midterm is on Wednesday. Okay? I already mentioned the exam is on Wednesday here in this room at 6 o'clock. Okay? Any questions about any logistics of the midterm? I have also put a note on the course schedule indicating this. Any last minute questions about the project? Yes. Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
You said that you want the reducer threads to print. Can we just have the main thread print whatever the reducer thread needs?
That's fine.
That's fine.
Good. Yep.
Right. Sorry. Can you say that we should expect NNM to be input for the program, but we should prompt for the number of math threads and the number of reducer threads?
You could. Yes, you could send it in the command line and that would be perfectly acceptable. If you don't do that, you should at least prompt for it and accept it as keyboard input. Okay, but you could just, I'm sorry?
Can you email the whole
class? Yes, absolutely. I will email the whole class. As soon as we are done with class, I'll go read up the doc and then send that out. Yes.
Well, it's just because the TA made some code and he made some aliases for those functions, acquire and release, and it was, there's weight. Or something, and so like within those functions, he used acquire what he asked for, not just.
I see. Okay, so I actually wasn't aware what he has. So let me also look at that. He's probably put that up on Spark.
Yeah, it was on Spark.
Was that yesterday that he did this?
It was like last week.
Last week. Okay. Let me. I'll send clarification out as soon as the class is done. Yes.
The number of occurrences of each word in each file or in all the files?
Totally. Global. Global word code. Not per file. Yep.
Instructions say that like math thread 1 will read both 1.txt. But is it okay if we start from 0? Like go 0.txt and then just say.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. You can even supply the list of file names on the command line. And then they could be named whatever you want them to be named. Okay, although that's fine. The important part of this project is to get the synchronization and threading right. Okay, that we will allow more leeway and exactly how the input is sent into the program and what you are printing out. The syntax, we sent some samples yesterday, but we are not very concerned about did you put a space between these two things or not. It's not auto-graded, so we are actually going to look at what you are producing. It's important to get the logic of the synchronization and threading right. That's really the goal of this assignment. Okay? Okay. So, let's move on. We are starting, going to start a new topic today, but this is basically just a reminder of where we are in the course. So we have thus far covered three important topics: processes and threads, CPU scheduling, synchronization and deadlock. Okay, so that's already done. Next up is memory management. Okay, and then two more topics remain beyond this, which is file systems and I/O storage and distributed system. Okay, so the next several classes will be spent on memory management. Okay, this is also a good maybe 25% of the course, although it looks like one bullet here. There are various subtopics here that we will cover. Today's class is going to involve a high level overview, okay, of memory management. Okay, then we'll go into the details of virtual memory. We'll look at demand paging. We'll look at various forms of memory management, segmentation, all of these things. Okay, that's coming down the road. Now we'll start with the introduction of what's memory management. Okay, so what is this topic about? So basically, in this topic, what we are going to learn is where are processes stored in memory when they're executing? What does the OS do to manage multiple processes that are all loaded in memory or present in memory at the same time? Okay, how does it allow this? How does it enforce protection across processes? How does it prevent one memory or other one process or thread from accessing the address space of some other thread, and so on? Okay, then we'll also learn this notion of an memory address. Okay, how do programs generate memory addresses? What does the OS do with these memory addresses, and so on? Okay, so that's basically the gist of today's lecture. Okay, so let me start with some background here. So this is basically the same picture I had shown when we did a review of computer architecture, but with a few more details. So here we have the CPU, you have disk, you have memory. Okay, so typically your program initially resides on disk. Okay, it's compiled, or it could be, if it's Java, it's interpreted. Okay, when you start up that program, which is stored on disk, the OS will load it into memory, load it into RAM. Okay, so the program becomes a process because it begins execution, is stored in RAM. Okay, and what the OS essentially does is it starts executing the program, which essentially means it goes through the program, fetches one instruction at a time, executes that instruction, does what the instruction tells it, gets the next instruction, and so on. Okay, so there is code that is loaded here, binary. Okay, binary code, and then you have your processor, it is fetching instructions from here and executing them. Okay, and this process in RAM will also have some data that's also stored in RAM, not just the code. Okay, so anytime the instruction requires you to access data, data also has to be fetched from RAM into registers, and you modify that data, you may store it back to memory, and so this is essentially how your program is going to execute. Okay, there are some important things here which we will look at in the context of memory management. One important component is the TLB and the MMU. MMU stands for the memory management unit. Okay, TLB stands for translation look aside buffer. I don't know if any of you have heard of these terms in 201. I presume it came across, right? So we'll look at what TLB does, what MMU does. So these are the TLB is a cache. Okay, that is used to make memory access more efficient. Here we'll look at how the OS uses these hardware components to do memory management. Okay, any questions about this picture? Okay, so this only shows you one CPU, or one core rather. You might have more than one, okay, in your modern machines, and the same picture has to be replicated, okay, if you have more than one core. But for the purposes of this topic, we'll assume that there's only one core, in which means there will not be any contention on memory and so on. If you have multiple cores, then multiple cores will fetch instructions simultaneously from memory. There may be memory contention, which the memory controller has to deal with. Okay, but that is not something we'll worry about here. Okay, so with that background, let's look at some terminology. Okay, so you have RAM there, and there's a picture there which shows the OS and three programs, or three processes in this case, that have been loaded into memory A, B, and C. Okay, there are some memory addresses that are shown, and we'll look at what those all mean. Okay, so we'll define this term segment as a chunk of memory that has been assigned to a process. Okay, so in this case, this is a segment that's been assigned to process B, that's a segment that's assigned to process C, and so on. Okay. Physical address, by physical address we will mean a real address in memory. Okay. In this case, memory addresses go from word or byte 0 to 2400. Okay. Those are physical addresses. They give you actual addresses of locations in memory. Okay. Physical that's what we mean by physical address. Okay. A virtual address, okay, essentially means that it's an address relative to the process's address space. Okay. So here, for instance, okay, this is process B. Okay, process B has 400, in this case, let's say it's bytes. Okay, process B is 400 bytes in size. So the instructions within that process will generate addresses. Okay, and they may generate address relative to the start of the program. Okay, rather than physical addresses that are basically in the physical address for B goes from 2000 to 2400. Okay, virtual addresses will go from 0 to 400. Okay, the OS has to then translate virtual addresses to physical addresses, and we'll see how that is done. Okay, so many processes will actually generate virtual addresses, and we'll see why they generate virtual addresses as opposed to physical addresses as well. Okay, but it's important to understand the difference between the two. These are real addresses in memory. Virtual addresses are addresses relative to where the program is or the process is loaded in the address space. So let's try to understand why there is a distinction between the two. So to understand that, we have to see where addresses are generated, how they are generated. Okay? So they could be generated at compile time, load time, or execution time. Okay? If addresses are generated at compile time, this essentially says that the compiler makes some assumption about where this process is going to be loaded in memory by the OS when it runs. Okay? And based on those assumptions, it will generate assembly instructions, okay, with the right address embedded in those instructions. Okay? These would be physical addresses. Okay? So the compiler generates exact physical location in memory starting from some fixed location. Okay? So typical assumption that the OS may make, not the OS, the compiler. Compiler may make is that here is your OS. It could assume that process is loaded here. Okay, so it will assume, make an assumption that is loaded at some fixed location k. Here let's assume k is equal to 0. If it assumes this, then when it generates assembly instruction, it might have an assembly instruction that says something like this. Okay, so it says move the value that's stored at physical address 1200, it's not 1200, let's say 900. Okay, so here is 900. So it says move that value that's stored in that memory location into this register. Okay, so it's already generated assembly code with the physical addresses embedded there. Okay, the only way it can do this is to make an assumption about where this process is going to reside in memory at runtime. Okay, if it can make that assumption, then it can generate physical addresses at compile time itself. Is that clear what I just said? Any questions on this? Okay, so that's compile time addresses. Okay, the next way to do this, okay, you have a question.
How does the compiler know that address is not going to be used?
How is the compiler know which, where it's going to be loaded? Yes. This will only work under special scenarios. So if you have an operating system, okay, that only runs one program at a time, uniprogramming systems, okay, then it can assume that the program is loaded at location 0. There is nothing else running. Okay? So if in systems like this, it's okay for the compiler to generate physical addresses. In most real systems, the compiler will not know ahead of time where the operating system is actually going to load the program into memory. So it cannot do this. Okay? But there are systems where you might only run one program at a time. Okay? And today's, let's say, smartphone, some smartphone, not the more modern ones, may run only one program. In that case, it's okay for the program or the process to reside at a certain known location in memory, and it's fine for you to generate those addresses. Okay, embedded systems are another example. Okay, there may be only one program running on this embedded microcontroller, and it's fine to make these assumptions. Okay, but modern machines will not use this kind of architecture. Okay, so we'll have to do something else. Okay. So the other way to generate addresses is at load time. In this case, the compiler will generate an address, okay, but it's a relative address. It's an address relative to the process's starting position. Okay? And you have to, when you load the program into memory, you go and look for all of those addresses and adjust them based on where you actually load them into memory. Okay? So this is referred to as load time. And once you have loaded the process, you cannot move it because you have generated those addresses. Okay? So an example is, you can use the same example. Okay, let's say there's code for program A that the compiler is generating. Okay? The compiler does not know ahead of time where the OS is going to load this process. Okay? So it will, let's say, make an assumption that all addresses are relative to the start of the process. So it's, you will have this instruction which says move this word, okay, or this byte 900, which is relative to the start of the process. So 900 byte from the beginning of the process, move that to location or register R1. Okay, you will generate an assembly instruction of this form. Okay. Now, depending on where your program is actually loaded, right? So let's say when you run this, let's say 1000. Okay, when you load this program, you load it starting location 1000. So in that case, when you load it, what the OS has to do, there's a program called a loader that's actually loading this code into RAM. It has to scan through all of the instructions and adjust its memory addresses appropriately. Okay? So if you load it, if you load this process A at location 100, okay, all addresses have to be adjusted relative to the base of this program. Okay? So address 900 relative to the beginning has to be adjusted as 1900. Okay, because that's the physical address that you are really referring to, which is location 900 from the beginning is 1900. Okay, so you scan through the instruction, you adjust the memory addresses, and then this is what gets loaded. Okay, this adjusted code. Okay, that is the job of this this program called a loader to do this. Any questions on this? Okay, this is where you decide on what addresses you are going to spit out from your instructions at load time. Okay, and once you loaded the program, you cannot move it around. Okay, because if you move this program, then all addresses are incorrect. Okay, because 1900 will refer to some other byte, not the one you have intended. And the last and the most flexible model is to generate addresses at execution time. Here you make no a priori assumption about where the program is going to reside in memory. You make no assumptions of whether the program is going to be moved once it has started executing. You allow the OS to do all of those things. It can load the program wherever it wants. It can move the program whenever it wants from one location in RAM to another location. Okay? So in this case, the only thing you can do is to generate a relative address and have the OS translate that to the actual address at runtime, at execution time. When the instruction is about to execute, that's the time you actually figure out what address did the compiler actually mean to generate. Okay, so how would you do that here? So you have this instruction, okay, saying move R1 900. This is actually what gets loaded here. It's not changed at compile time. It's saying I want to access the 900th byte relative to the start of this process, okay, and move that relative address into register R1. Okay. Suppose that the OS actually loads this program here. Okay, how do you generate the physical address that instruction is referring to? Sorry? It's not the TLB, but it's a piece of hardware. It's not done in the TLB. But let's not worry about how the hardware does it. What would you have to do? What does the OS have to do? Sorry? Is the problem clear? What we are... The problem isn't clear, then I should first explain what the problem is perhaps. So, the compiler is generating assembly code. The compiler does not know where the process is going to be loaded. Okay? It has stored a piece of variable at this location, which is 900th byte from the beginning of the process. It wants to load that word into the register. Okay? So what can the compiler do at compile time? The only thing it can do is take relative address 900 and move it to this register. It doesn't know what the physical address is. It only knows this virtual address. Okay? and the OS is free to load the program wherever it wants, and we assume that the process is now resident at these at this location in RAM, okay, starting at address 1000 to 2000. Okay. Now you have to, when this instruction is about to be executed, you have to translate this relative address to a physical address, which is that. Okay. Yes. 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 Exactly right. So what the OS has to do is to keep track what is the starting address of this process, and for each relative address that this assembly instruction is embedded in any assembly instruction, it has to start the base address. This is called the base address of the program. Okay. So it will do this addition at execution time, and what will actually get executed is this. So it's going to do this for you. So each relative address is dynamically translated into a physical address. Okay. This is done using a hardware called base registers. We'll see those that in a moment. Okay. So it should be clear where all these addresses are coming from. In one case, you generate physical addresses at compile time. The OS doesn't have to do anything. Okay. The OS only loads the program at a certain location that the compiler knows about. Okay. And then the compiler has generated physical address. In the second case, the compiler generates relative addresses, but when the OS loads the program, it adjusts all the relative addresses. It does this addition, okay, not at execution time, but when you load the program, it goes and adjusts all of the addresses by adding that base address to each relative address. Okay. At that point, physical addresses are generated. No additional steps have to be taken when you execute the instruction. Okay. The disadvantage here is you cannot move the process once it's loaded. Okay. The last and the most flexible case is where you load the relative addresses, and as the instruction is about to execute, you translate each relative address to the physical address using the base address for that process. Okay. So this should tell you that it's trivial to move the process. You can move it to any other location, you will just change the base address. Okay. So any subsequent instruction, you just add a different offset and you get the right physical address. Is this clear? Okay. So now we'll start with the simplest model, which is uniprogramming, and then we'll build up to how multiple processes can reside in memory all at the same time. Okay, uniprogramming is what was used in very early operating system, like DOS and early mainframe operating system. It allowed you to only run one program at one process at a time. Okay, so the memory management model was very simple. You always assume that the processes are loaded at address 0. Processes are given a contiguous chunk of memory. Okay, so then the compiler can use that assumption to generate physical addresses. Okay, so in uniprogramming systems, you can actually do this, which is the compiler can generate physical addresses because it knows where the process resides. Okay. The maximum size of any process is the RAM size minus the size of the OS. Okay? The OS is resident here in the high memory region. Okay? Processes are loaded starting location 0, so you can have a process that can be at most that large in size. Okay? RAM size minus OS kernel size is the maximum size of a process. Okay? And the OS can then, or the hardware can do some address checks to ensure that it this process here does not refer to any address in the OS kernel access, so you can protect the operating system from the program and vice versa. So you can do these checks. This is a picture of what I've just drawn here. It shows three different scenarios, three different processes, okay, A, B, and C of different sizes. In all cases, you have RAM of size 2400. Okay, here process A is loaded. This is free space. Okay, this is memory. It's not allocated to anything. Okay, here you have much larger free space because B is small, and then C is the largest process. Okay, so very simple memory management model. Not much has to be done because you are making some simplifying assumptions, which is only one process runs at a time. Only one process is resident in memory at a time. So you can make these assumptions saying process is always start at physical address 0, can generate physical addresses at compile time and so on. Now the problem with this clearly is that if you have only one process running and that process blocks on I/O, your CPU will be idle because there is nothing else to run. There's only one process resident in RAM. Okay, so you cannot overlap IO and computation and make good use of resources on your machine. Okay? This is why most modern systems allow multi-programming, which is they allow multiple processes to be resident. If one process blocks, goes on this wait queue, then there are other processes that are still in the ready queue, you can run one of them. You can context switch to one of those. Okay, so now we want a memory management model that will allow multi-programming. Okay? We have implicitly assumed multi-programming when we did CPU scheduling. Okay? We said we could switch between processes that assume that multiple processes are already resident in memory. Okay? Now we are going to see what you need to do from a memory management standpoint to let these processes actually be resident. Okay? So we want three properties. We want transparency, safety, and efficiency. Okay? Transparency essentially says that the fact that multiple processes are resident in RAM should be transparent to processes. A process need not know or care how many processes are resident. Okay, it only needs to worry about itself. That's basically what it says. No process should be aware of how memory is shared. Processes should not care about which region in RAM they have been allocated to. Okay, you might have one process here, another process somewhere else. It should all work as if you are the only process in the system. Okay, so that's what transparency means. Okay. Safety essentially says that processes shouldn't trample on one another. Okay. Multiple processes are loaded in RAM. You shouldn't inadvertently give access to some other process's address space to some process. Okay. This is the safety property. Okay. So processes shouldn't corrupt each other. They shouldn't be able to corrupt the OS. The OS is basically the only process in the system that has full access to the entire RAM, okay, because it's a privileged process. The other processes only have access to their own address spaces. They cannot access any other address space. So how do you ensure this? Okay, this has to be done at a hardware level. We'll look at this. Okay. But you need this property. Okay. And the last one is efficiency. Okay, so the performance of the CPU and memory should not be degraded due to this sharing. Okay, we'll see what that means. Because you have to do extra work to generate these addresses by doing things like this at runtime. Okay, this incurs overhead. Okay, and this overhead shouldn't slow down the performance of your system. Okay, so you want all of these nice things, but yet you don't want to lose out on performance. Okay, so we'll look at techniques and then we'll come back to these properties and see did these techniques meet those goals. Okay, so the first technique is called relocation. Yeah, so I already mentioned what relocation does when I was talking about load time address generation. Okay, so here we have a picture where two processes are currently resident, A and B. A third process is now loaded into memory. Okay, and it's given a chunk of memory, okay, of size 300 starting at location 900. Okay, so here this is basically load time address generation. So what you do is that the compiler generates assembly instructions assuming the process is loaded at address 0. Okay, and at load time you actually see where the process is going to be loaded in memory, and then you go and adjust all of these relative addresses and offset them based on the base address, okay, for that process. Okay, that's exactly what I showed here. So in this case what would happen is all of the relative addresses that are present in any assembly instruction of C, you will add 900 to it. Okay, because you assumed that the process was going to be loaded at 0 and you generated all the addresses. It's actually at 900, so all the addresses are off by 900. So you go and add 900 to every memory address, and then all your assembly instructions refer to the right memory locations. Okay, this process of adding these memory offsets to is referred to as relocation. Okay. Essentially, you are relocating the process from one location to another. The implicit location that you assumed was starting at 0, but it's loaded at some other location, so you have to go and adjust this address. Okay. That process, which is done by the loader, okay, is referred to as relocation. Okay. And there are two concepts here, which is the base address and the limit address. Base address is the starting address for this process. The limit address is the ending address. Okay. And all addresses that this process generates have to lie between the base and the limit address for reasons of safety. Okay? If you generate any address that is not in that range, okay, that means you are accessing RAM that's not allocated to you. Okay? The only RAM that's been allocated to you in this case is between 900 and 1200. The base is 900, the limit is 1200. Okay? So if you are only allowed to access your own address space and nothing else, then it follows that all assembly instructions in that process, okay, must only refer to addresses that lie between 900 and 1200. Okay? If you try to access address 1300, for instance, that should result in an error. Okay, that's what is referred to as segmentation fault. So you try to access a memory address that was out of range, your process gets terminated by the OS. Okay, you should make that error. Okay? So this is relocation. Any questions on this? Okay, so there are two types of relocation. Okay, what I talked about thus far is actually referred to as static relocation. Okay, so here the relocation is actually done at load time. Okay, the load time, the OS adjusts the addresses of all of the assembly instruction to reflect its position in memory, and once you assign this process to a certain location and start executing it, you can't move it. Okay, because if you move the process, then all the addresses are going to be incorrect. You have to actually do the relocation if you move the thing. So if you do it only at load time, then you are stuck with that location. Okay. Dynamic relocation does this at execution time. This is where you generate the address at execution time. You do nothing at load time. Okay, you just load the process with all relative addresses. Okay, with all addresses, assuming the process is loaded at location 0, and then you have this logic in hardware. Okay, the assembly instruction gives you a logical address. Okay, the logical address assumes that you are loaded at location 0, and then you have this relocation register. This relocation register stores the starting address for that process. Okay, so in the previous case, the relocation register for C would have what address? Should have 900. Okay, the starting address for C is 900, so the relative, this register will have 900. Okay, so anytime you generate a logical address, you take this register, you take that logical address, you sum it, and that gives you the physical address. Okay, so this is logic that's already present in hardware. Okay, so when the OS executes this process, it has to fill in the right value in the relocation register. Okay, and then those CPU is going to execute some instruction, it's going to spit out an address. You actually translate that at execution time. Okay, this is exactly what I was showing here. Okay, this value here is stored in that register. Okay, and that is, how do you get the logical address? That is what is generated. Okay, this is your logical address. You assume that when the compiler generates code, assembly code, it assumes that the process is going to be loaded at location 0, okay? Which means all addresses are generated relative to that start of the process, which is 0. So it has actually generated move R1 900. This is the code it has generated. This is your logical address. Is that clear?
So that's the relocation register?
No, the relocation register, I think there is some confusion. So for this example, the relocation register has value 1000. Okay. The relative address is 900 bytes from the start of this process. So you take 900, you take 1000, so its physical address is 1900. Okay, so you will basically generate that instruction which says move R1 900 will actually generate 900. Okay. The relocation register has value 1000. In that example, you'll add it up and you get 1900, which is the physical address. Okay, so this hardware is going to be present that does all of this. Okay, and here is additional safety check that you are performing. Okay, so here's the limit register. Okay, and it checks, is the logical address out of bounds? That's essentially what it is checking. Okay, if it's out of bound, it's basically going to generate a trap, which is an addressing error. This prevents this process from accessing any memory that does not belong to it. So if you generate an address, so if your size is 1000, okay, you generate a relative address which let's say is 1500. If you did not do that check, okay, you would be able to access this memory location which is not assigned to you. This is the memory chunk that's assigned to you. Okay? So you generate an out of bounds error, which is why you have to do this extra check. Okay? The limit register stores the ending address for the process. It says, is this going to exceed the limit register? Yes, question.
Is the relocation that's assigned
to you in the register? Do they need to add for it? These are, this defined together, they define where in memory are you loaded. Okay? This is the starting address, that's the ending address. The two independent registers, one stores the beginning of the process, the other one stores the last address. And all you are doing checking is, are you actually accessing something that's out of bounds.
So it only checks the logical address, by the flow?
You can check, if you check the logical address, this has to store the size of the process, not the ending address of the process. If you check against this, okay, there are different machines that do different things. If you check against this, this is the ending address. So you either put the size of the process or the ending address depending on whether you are checking against this or this. Okay? So in this case, you would put the limit register would have the size, okay, not the last address. Any other questions on this?
So the logical address is basically like the size of the process.
The limit, the logical address is just any address that is relative to the start of the process. Let me redraw this picture. This thing's cluttered. Okay, so let's say this is RAM. Let's say this is a process. Process loaded at location, physical address. Okay. That these are physical addresses. It's actually loaded at byte number 1000 in RAM, goes to byte 2000 in RAM. Okay. The compiler does not know where your process is going to be loaded. No, what it will assume at compile time is that the process is actually loaded at the beginning of RAM. Okay, which means it assumes that you are actually loaded at location 0. So you might have okay, so you will have an assembly instructions of this form. Let's say you may have assembly instructions of this form. These are all addresses that are generated by the compiler, but they are relative to the start of the process. Okay, this one refers to byte 900 from the beginning. This one refers to byte 500 from the beginning. Okay, these are all called logical addresses. That's this. Because when you execute this instruction, move R1 900, you will basically say move the 900, move what is stored at the 900 byte in memory into the register. Okay, but this is not a real address. It's just an address relative to the beginning of the process. So the real address in this case is going to be 1900, because the 1900 byte, the 900 byte from the beginning here is this location. Okay, that's the translation that's being done here. This register will have the base address, which is 1000. Okay, you generate 900, you add the two, you get 1900. Okay? That clear? Any confusion there? Simple arithmetic at the end of the day. It is important to understand what the concept is or why you have to do all of this. Okay? Okay, this is referred to as dynamic relocation. As I said, what this allows you to do is to move the process. Okay? So if this process, you can actually take this whole process and move it somewhere else. You can move it somewhere else here. And then all you have to do It just change this value and this value. And then all the addresses are automatically adjusted, because it's still the 900th byte from the beginning of the process. It's just that the beginning of the process has changed, so the physical address has changed, and you can just regenerate that by changing what is stored in that register. Okay. Now you might ask a question, why should you ever move a process once it's loaded in memory? Okay, why do we care about this extra flexibility? So why would you want to move a process? There are many reasons, but think of what the simplest one may be. Yes.
You want to move it out of RAM?
Yes, you want to move it out of RAM for temporarily and then bring it back. That's one reason. And when you bring it back, the location from where you moved it out may be used by some other process. So you have to bring it back to a different location. Yes.
Maybe you've got fragmentation in the RAM. You want to defragment.
You might have to defragment. We haven't talked about fragmentation, so that's absolutely right. But there are even simpler reasons. The process may grow or shrink. Okay, you may dynamically allocate a class, an object, a variable. You do new and do something. You have to allocate more RAM. Okay? What if there is another process? So suppose this process needs 100 more bytes, but there is another process loaded here. Okay, so it cannot grow when you try to execute this new thing. The only way to grow it is to move it to a larger chunk of memory that's available somewhere else. Okay? In this case, where we do contiguous allocation, you have to move. Okay? Real operating systems don't allocate contiguous pieces of chunk. They actually divide the memory up and allocate smaller chunks. Okay? But if you are using contiguous allocation as your memory management scheme, and your process grows and there is no room to grow, you have to take the process and move it somewhere else. Put it in a region where it can actually grow. And if you don't have that region, you cannot grow the process, you are allowed to terminate it. You will not have enough RAM. Okay? So these are reasons why you want this flexibility. So here advantages and disadvantages. Advantages, I already said, you can move during execution. It allows the process to grow or shrink over time. Okay? And the hardware that you need to do all of this is relatively fast. Okay, it's a register. Okay, two extra registers are needed here. You need to an adder and a comparator, okay, which are very efficient to implement. So this does not add a huge amount of performance overhead. Okay, we said one of the properties we want is efficiency. Okay, addition logic to do addition and comparison in hardware is fairly efficient. Okay, so this is not going to add lot of overhead, so you can still do this efficiently. Okay. The disadvantage is that although it is efficient, it's still slower, okay, than the compile time and the load time. Okay. The compile time, where you actually generated addresses when you loaded, you don't have to do any of this. Okay, because addresses are already generated when you load the program in memory, so it's still faster, or those are still faster, so it's somewhat slower. I mean, this logic is somewhat slower than the compile time and the load time memory reference generation. Another big problem is you cannot share memory across processes. Okay. Each process has a contiguous segment which is mutually exclusive. Okay. A and C cannot share any regions here. Okay. It's much harder to do that. There are ways to do this, but you have to generalize these techniques. Okay. Big limitation is process is still limited by the size of RAM. The entire process has to fit in RAM. Okay. And not only that, all the processes that are currently running have to fit in RAM in this case. Okay, so maximum size of a process is size of RAM. Actually, size of RAM minus the size of the OS. Okay, that's the amount of available RAM. You cannot have a process that exceeds that. And if you have 10 processes, they better all fit. Yeah, otherwise you can't implement this thing. Okay. So those are all disadvantages. We'll see more sophisticated memory management techniques that relax all of these assumptions. Okay, you can have process, single process that can be 10 times the size of RAM. It doesn't matter. You can have hundreds of processes which don't all fit in RAM all at the same time. Okay, we can do all of these nice things, but not with this scheme. Any questions here? Okay, so now let's go back to those properties we wanted. is this transparent? Okay. Yes, processes are largely unaware of sharing. They are just generating logical addresses. Some hardware is doing the translation. They don't know about the presence of other processes. Okay. They can't access anyone else's memory because there are limit registers that are doing checks saying, are you accessing any memory that's out of bounds? Okay. So you are largely unaware of the sharing. It's safe because every memory reference is checked using a limit register, so you cannot access someone else's RAM, okay, or modify it. Okay, and it is efficient because I argued here that the hardware you need to implement this scheme is very simple. It needs some extra registers, it needs an adder, it needs a comparator, fairly easy to implement. Okay. Now the only problem is if the process grows and you have to move it, then the scheme is not efficient. Okay, because moving large chunks of memory, okay, is slow. Okay, you are copying, let's say, hundreds of megabytes. Okay, in this case, it's only 1000 bytes, but real RAM you may have gigabytes. You have a process that takes 100 MB, and you have to move it somewhere, you have to copy 100 megabytes of memory from one region to another. Okay, that can be slow. Okay, so that part of it, if the processes are growing and shrinking and you have to move them around, is not efficient. Okay, the generation of memory, physical addresses, the checks, those are all efficient. Okay. So, now we have to ask the question, what does the OS have to do when it is loading multiple processes in memory and so on? Okay, how does it know where to put a piece of, where to put a process, how to deallocate RAM and whatnot? Okay. That's memory allocation. Okay, this picture shows you the basic concept. Okay. The OS has to track which processes are currently running and where they are loaded in memory. Okay. The corollary to this is it has to keep track of what is available space in RAM. Okay. In this case, anything that's in gray is space that's not allocated to any process. Okay. So when a new process loads, it has to find a region of memory where it will fit and it can put it there. Okay. So here is an example. So initially you have the OS and your three processes A, B and C. Okay, this is is available space. Okay, let's say process B finishes. Okay, so it goes away, it releases its RAM. So now you have these two regions that are all available for use. Okay, and process D comes in. Okay, and D is given, it needs 600 bytes as you can see there. Okay, there's only one place to put it, which is here. Okay, here you have 300 bytes free. There you have 900. Okay, so D has to go here. Okay, so you put D here. Now these are two regions in memory that you are available. A goes away. Okay, A finishes. Now you have to track these three regions that's available. Okay. So the OS has to keep track of free space in RAM. It has to keep track of what is used. Okay. And whenever a new process comes in, you have to say this process needs X amount of RAM. And you find a region from your available list to say where should I put this process. Okay, and then you can allocate that region to that process. So all of this is done by the memory manager or the memory management component of the OS kernel. Okay, the OS kernel has to keep track of all of these things. Yes, question.
So it's not always that the OS has to be the one that manages memory, right? You can write your own memory allocator.
Okay, so memory allocator is different from process level memory management. Okay. Let me explain exactly what I mean by this. Okay, so in this case, you are allocating a certain region of RAM to a process. Okay. Within that process, although you have not yet looked at what's in here, okay, within that process, there's going to be a code segment, there's going to be a stack segment, and there's going to be a heap segment. Okay. Heap segment is whatever this what you allocate on the fly. When you do a new, you will actually take some piece from here and allocate it to some. Okay. So your memory allocator that you are referring to is actually trying to manage memory within this process, not across processes. The OS is actually managing the entire RAM. Okay. Once you allocate this chunk to this process, what the process does with it is not the OS's problem. Okay. It will have stack, it will allocate and deallocate RAM of stack, there will be a heap and whatnot. Okay. Now each of these gray shaded regions here that are in this picture, they are referred to as holes. They are holes in memory where nothing is allocated. Okay. So whenever a new process loads, okay, the OS has to decide which hole to allocate. Okay. to this process. And there are different policies to do this. And we'll see several, three different policies. Is there any question about this picture? Okay, so keep in mind the memory management unit has to keep track of two things. What parts of memory are in use? Okay, that's one thing. And what the corollary to that is what parts are available for allocation. Okay, so chunks that are available for allocation are referred to as holes in memory. Because as you can see, if you look at the layout, these just look like holes that are not filled in. Okay, when a new process loads, you say what's the size of this process? How much should I allocate it? You look for a hole that is large enough to accommodate that process, and then that process goes there. So in this case, for instance, this was a hole, you allocated part of that hole to D. Okay, so D is allocated some chunk, it creates a smaller hole that the OS has to keep track of. Okay? So here are three policies that the OS can use. Okay? So first policy is called first fit, then there's one called best fit, there's one called worst fit. Okay? So given a list of holes, in this case you have two. Okay, in this case you have three. Okay, given a list of holes and a new process that you want to execute, depending on which hole you pick, okay, you have these different policies. So first fit says just search through this list, and the first hole that you find that is big enough to accommodate that process is allocated to that process. This is referred to as the first fit policy. You find the first hole where the process fits. Okay, so if you are doing a linear search, okay, you will basically start here for that D and say, is this big enough? Answer is yes, you are done. So just allocate this hole, it gets a part of it, and there is another hole that's created. Okay, this is referred to as first fit. Best fit says, you actually don't stop as soon as you find a match, you find first fit is first match. Okay? Best fit says, I find the best match. Best match says, not only do I find a hole that's big enough, I find the smallest hole that's big enough, that's good enough for this process. Okay? So if the process has, let's say, size 1000, and you find that there are several holes that are available, one of size 1050, one size 1500, and size 2000, okay? These are all holes that are big enough to accommodate that process. Okay? Best fit will say pick this hole, because it's the biggest, it's the smallest of these feasible ones that is big enough. Okay. First fit just is scan linearly, find the first match. Okay, it doesn't matter if you are scanning this way, you would have actually allocated that one. Because all of these are good enough. It says doesn't matter which one, moment you find a match, just allocate it. Best fit just scan through all of them, okay, find the best possible match. Okay. And the worst fit does the exact opposite. Worst fit says allocate the largest hole to that process. So in this case, the worst fit would allocate 2000, okay, to that process. Okay? So let's try to understand these three. Okay. So what can you comment about first fit, best fit, and worst fit? What do you think will happen in any of these? Yes?
Well, compared to first fit and best fit, first fit is probably faster because it doesn't spend more time
Right. So if you are doing something very trivial, let's say you do linear search, okay, you have a list of holes, okay, of sizes, different sizes. If you are doing first fit, it's always going to be the fastest when you do linear search, because you moment you find a match, you stop, you don't look at the rest of the list. Okay, so first fit is fast.
The best fit is more when stable.
Right, so why do I ever do best fit? What is that giving you?
It's leaving you with less holes and
SOIs. Right. So why would you want to actually find the best match? You find the best match because you want to reduce the number of holes you have to keep track of. Okay? Because small holes are almost always useless. If you create a hole of size 50, the average size of your process, let's say, is 500, this hole will never get used. Right, so you want to avoid creating lots of holes. So you try to find the best match, and these small holes you will just ignore because you will not allocate to anything. Okay. So you will talk about fragmentation, which is the process of creating small holes and causing problems in just a moment. But let's think about worst fit. Okay. Why find the largest one? Sorry?
Because it will always fit. If it doesn't, then...
Well, it will fit. Any of those, it will always fit. But what do you get by picking the biggest hole as opposed to the smallest one? Yes?
Maybe if it's a process that you know is going to grow or something, then I'm not sure how much it's going to grow.
Yes. One thing is, if the process grows, you have more space. Definitely true.
How do you know the process will grow?
Okay, you don't know. I'm just guessing. You have no idea. Sorry? Yes, the other important insight. One is, it allows you more room to grow than best fit. Best fit will allow less room, obviously. The other thing is, it creates bigger holes. You pick the biggest one and chop it up, what is left over is going to be much bigger than what best fit does. So in this case, you take this hole and you allocate it to this process. The residual hole is size 50. Okay? In this case, if you allocate a hole of size 2000, the residual hole is size 1000. Okay? If I give you these two policies and say, which would you pick? If you wanted to use this residual memory for some other process, worst fit is better. Because you're creating, taking a bigger hole, and then what is left over is still large enough. Okay? So this size hole or new hole you have created of size 1000 by chopping this space into two parts, one that goes here and the one that's residual, is still useful. In best fit, these small holes are often not useful. Okay, so there are these two trade-offs between best and worst fit. Okay. There are several studies that have been performed which says that typically first fit and best fit have better utilization. First fit is faster. Worst fit typically gives you these larger holes, but even then it's not used as frequently. Is one of the first two that are used, which is best fit or worst fit. Okay, but it's important to know that worst fit, although doesn't sound like a useful policy, there is still some use to having worst fit. Okay, is this clear? Any questions here? The next assignment will require some knowledge of these three things, programming assignment, that is. So if you have any questions, this is a good time to ask. Okay. So let's talk about fragmentation now. So as you can imagine, initially when the OS boots up, you essentially only have the kernel and all of your memory is free. Okay, there's one hole which is the entire size of RAM. Okay. As processes come and go, they are loaded in different regions, okay, and you keep creating new holes. Okay, so in this case, so you started with one hole here. Okay, and then B went away, D came in. It left two holes, eventually A went away, you left with three holes and so on. So over a period of time, what you have is a lot of small holes that get created in your system. And this process or this problem is referred to as fragmentation. You are fragmenting memory into small chunks, small available chunks. Okay? And the chunks often are small enough that you cannot put them to any good use because no single process fits into this small chunk. Okay? So that's not a good thing to have. This is called fragmentation. Okay? Fragmentation of memory. Okay? Different problem from fragmentation of disk. You may have seen file system fragmentation and whatnot. It's a similar problem but not the same thing. Okay? When we talk about file systems, we talk about disk fragmentation. This is memory fragmentation. Okay? So there are two types of fragmentation. Okay? You have what's called external fragmentation and internal fragmentation. So external fragmentation is said to exist when the total size of free RAM is enough to accommodate a process, but there is no single hole that's big enough to accommodate it. Okay, so going back to this picture here, okay, let's take this picture. Okay, so what's the size of available RAM here? How many bytes? Okay, that's the size of this hole and size of this hole. This hole is size 300. This hole is size 300. Okay, so available RAM is 600 bytes. Okay, so suppose a process comes in and its size is 500. Okay, it wants 500 bytes. As far as available RAM is concerned, you have enough space. You have 600 bytes free. Okay, but because you are allocating memory in contiguous chunks, neither of these two holes can accommodate a process of size 500 because this is 300 and this is 300. Okay. This problem is referred to as external fragmentation. You have enough RAM,
Yeah, but this RAM, available RAM, free RAM is scattered across lots of little holes. Okay? So you cannot fit a process, okay, that wants that RAM, but the holes cannot accommodate that process. Okay? This is referred to as external fragmentation. There's only one way to deal with this problem, which is to do what is called defragmentation or compaction. Okay? The only way to recover this small thing is to move processes around. So if you move C up, okay, then you create a new hole of size 600. That allows you to now accommodate this new process of size 500. But that is an expensive process, and expensive and slow. Defragmentation or compaction of memory is slow. We will talk about that also in the next slide, but let's finish the discussion here. Okay? So external fragmentation exists when there is enough memory to fit a process, but no hole is big enough to accommodate that process. Okay? And this problem will occur. If you use contiguous allocation over a period of time as processes come and go, you will have lots of these little holes. Most of them are useless. Okay? But they have enough space between all of them to do something useful. Okay? And here is what's called a 50% rule. Okay? So if you do some simulations or you actually try this out on any sequence of arrivals and departures of processes, it says whenever you have 2n chunks allocated to some processes, up to n chunks, typically on an average, because it's not a hard and fast rule, this is just on saying over long periods of time, on an average, every time you allocate 2n chunks, up to n blocks are lost to fragmentation. It says effectively, when you do contiguous allocation, up to a third of your RAM is essentially useless, because it's not all spread across little holes that you cannot put to any good use. Okay, so contiguous allocation, the biggest problem is that you are not making good use of RAM, because you are requiring that processes be stored contiguously in RAM. Okay, this contiguous allocation requirement creates all these holes and fragmentation that you cannot put to good use. And up to a third of RAM typically gets wasted in operating systems that use this scheme. Okay? And only way to recover that is to periodically run compaction and recover this space and create this contiguous free space. Okay? So we'll look at our policies that minimize or eliminate wasted space altogether. Not today, next time. Okay? What's internal fragmentation? Internal fragmentation is the opposite problem. It says that a process wants a certain amount of space. You allocate it space that's more than what it asked for. Okay? So there is internally within that process, there is some wasted RAM. External fragmentation says there is memory external to the processes that is wasted. Okay? Internal fragmentation says there is memory internal to the process that's wasted. So why would you allocate more RAM to a process than it is asking for? Okay? Independent of the fact that it might want to grow, you still want to do this. Okay? So here is an example that clarifies this. It says process asks for 8846 bytes. Okay? You do best fit and you find a hole that's 8848 bytes. Okay, just 2 bytes more than what the process asked for. Okay? So if you give the process exactly what it asked for, 8846, then you have this 2 byte hole that the OS has to keep track of. Essentially useless RAM. You will never allocate the 2 bytes or anything. In fact, I made this list much longer with this 2 byte hole. Every time you do a search, you have this one entry that's essentially adding to your search time because it's a useless entry. Okay, you're doing linear search, you have all these wasted entries in there. So it's better to just allocate that entire space to this memory, to this process, even though it didn't ask for the whole thing, and then get rid of this 2 byte hole that the OS has to deal with. Okay, so the OS perspective, less headaches, and take a couple bytes more, I don't have to deal with this hole. Okay. But this is referred to as internal fragmentation. You gave the process more memory than it needed, and if the process doesn't grow, that's still wasted memory. You still wasted that 2 bytes. So this problem is referred to as internal fragmentation. Okay. So both external and internal fragmentations are things you should avoid, as you as in the operating system needs to avoid as much as possible. Okay. Typically external fragmentation is the bigger problem. Internal fragmentation may exist, but it's much smaller part of the whole picture. Okay, so let's look at ways to deal with external fragmentation. You have a question?
I was just going to ask, when do you know like that it stops being just let the program use the whole block.
This thing?
Yeah.
This is a policy decision on part of the OS. It should say how small is a hole that is then effectively useless. So any hole that's, you can set some threshold, 50 bytes, 100 bytes, whatever that threshold is. So when you allocate a hole, if the residual hole is smaller than that threshold, you say, I don't want to deal with this, just give the whole chunk to the process. Okay, so the OS has to decide what that is in this case. Okay. So here is the algorithm that the OS can use, the defragmenter effectively, which is referred to as compaction here, to deal with this problem. Okay, so now, so this is the layout of memory. Okay, that's what we saw from that previous slide. Okay, now you have process E that has come in that needs 600. Okay, you have sufficient free space overall, but there is no hole that's big enough. Okay, the first one has 500 bytes. These two have 300 bytes each. Okay? That process needs 600. So somehow you have to move something, okay, to create enough space. Okay? And as you can see, compaction, there is no single good algorithm. You can do variety of things. Okay? So here is a full compaction. Okay? You do run full compaction, it takes all the processes and it just moves it up, so you have one large hole left at the end of this. Okay? This is full compaction policy. You can do this. It is move, it can potentially move all the processes in your system. So it is going to be slow and expensive, but you have reclaimed all of the wasted space at the end of this policy. Okay, it's a trade-off. You do more work, you reclaim more space. Okay? So now when this hole is created after compaction, then E can be easily accommodated as is shown here. Okay? Here's an alternative policy. It says, I don't want to do too much work. Do just enough work to reclaim space to accommodate that one process. So in this case, what could you do? You just move D up. Okay? In that case, you moved all the processes up. So you just move one process up. So you take this hole and you combine them. You got recovered a new hole that has size 800 and E will now fit in that hole as well. Okay? This is incremental compaction. Okay? This says do just enough work to reclaim enough wasted space and then live with that. So it's less expensive, but you still haven't reclaimed all of the space. You only reclaimed some of this portion. Yes. So, it says, are there other ways to do this? As you are pointing out, there's a smarter thing you could do, which is move this up, that reclaims more space here. Okay. So, incremental compaction, there are a variety of things you can do. Okay. You have to find out which things can be, what's the least number of processes that I can move to get the maximum reclamation. That's really what you want in incremental compaction. Yes, you could move C up here, you could move C up there. There are a variety of techniques and each will give you different amounts. So in this case, the overhead is the same. You are only moving 300 bytes. And you see, if I want to move 300 bytes, what's the maximum bang for the buck? What's the biggest hole I can create? Should I move that up here? Should I move that up there? In this case, moving it up there gets you this large hole. But so you have to ask, you may say, if I have 100 processes, what's the smallest number I can move? Let's say I want to move 5 or 8. Which 5 or 8 should I pick? Where do I move them so I reclaim the most? Okay. That, so that you need some smart policies to do that. We are not going to study that here. Okay, this is just to give you the basic idea of how compaction works. Okay. The simplest thing is to do this. It's also the most expensive. Okay. Here you say, I don't want to worry about this. Reclaim everything. Okay. Let it take a time, but I'm going to reclaim this.
What did you call the lower type?
This I just referred to as full. This is incremental. Okay, this is just saying I'll do some minimal work. Okay, so one more thing here, and then we'll stop. Okay, so that's compaction. Okay? Another thing you could do to create some space is what is referred to as swapping. Okay? Swapping essentially says roll out a process that's resident in RAM. If this process, let's say, is blocked on I.O., it's sitting in the ready queue, it's not doing anything, just take it out, swap it out onto disk. Okay? And then use its the space it has released to run something else. Okay? And when time comes to run that process again, let's say its I.O. is done, it's now going to go back on the ready queue, then bring it back in. Okay? So the OS continuously takes processes in RAM, puts them on disk, frees memory, uses them for something else. When the processes that are swapped out on disk are ready to run again, you bring them back in. Okay, so this technique is referred to as swapping. Okay? Now the only thing here is if you had used static relocation, then you are going to have less flexibility, because when you swap it back in, you have to bring that process back to the same location in RAM. If that region is taken up by some other process, then that process might have to be swapped out or evicted. If you have dynamic relocation, this is a lot more flexible. When you swap the process back in, you just look for a hole. Okay, you again do best fit, worst fit, or first fit. Just look for a hole that is appropriate and swap that process into a new location. Only thing you have to do is change the relocation register for that process, and everything is fine. Okay? So that's basically what swapping does. Swapping does says, rather than doing compaction, let me just, so if there are lots of processes, only one of them is executing, others are blocked, let me swap them out temporarily. I'll use that space to run other processes. When that process becomes ready to run, you bring it back in. Okay, and this works well if you have dynamic relocation, because it allows you the flexibility of swapping a process from a certain location in RAM and bringing that back into some other location and have it continue there. Here, continue execution. Now, as you can imagine, there is some interaction between swapping and CPU scheduling. You don't want to take a process that's on the ready queue that would have executed in the next, let's say, 200 milliseconds and put it out on disk. Okay, wasted work. Okay. Rather, you want to look at processes that are on the wait queue, that are waiting on slow I/O devices, and swap them out, because then you can use the speed of space for longer, okay, without having to bring that back in immediately. So you want to get the benefit of swapping. Swapping is also slow. Okay? It's even slower than compaction, because you're taking something from RAM and putting it, writing it out to a slow disk. Okay? Disk is orders of magnitude slower than RAM. Okay? So swapping is expensive, so you have to do it in a smart way so that you actually get the benefit for the price you pay to do swapping. Okay? So you have to, when you do swapping, you always have some interaction with the CPU scheduler that the OS needs to keep in mind, or the memory manager needs to keep in mind. Okay, so that's basically it for today. Okay? So what we have done now today is just started with some very simple memory management policies. Okay, next time we'll look at more sophisticated ones that relax some of these limitations. Okay, so let's stop here.